I don't see Rabbi Shur.
I'm here.
There he is.
How are you? So, Sabrina, I did see your message about dedicating the shiur. I'm happy to do that. Let's pull up the name. We can let's see. What, you can tell me the name right now, and we'll dedicate the shiur to your father's memory.
Hi, my father's name was Avram Abba Ben Shlomo.
Okay, so this shiur will be dedicated to the memory of Avram Abba Ben Shlomo.
Thank you.
No problem. So, as usual, I'm going to put everything on mute. If you have any questions, feel free to raise your hand, text, unmute, whatever Zoom method you have to ask questions. So I want to discuss today some ideas about Purim, and that we've been studying about Yosef for the past month or so. We've been through his story in depth, and I actually want to discuss how Purim and Yosef relate. And it's actually a fascinating topic. You know, I've thought about it a little bit in the past. I've never actually fully delved into it. But in looking into the connections, they're actually astounding. The connections in the Purim story and the story of Yosef, they're very, very interconnected. Many connections are made in terms of the themes of the two stories, in terms of the people. And in fact, I'm not going to get into it too much today in this class, but the textual references are abundant, meaning the wording used in Megillas Esther and the wording used in the story of Yosef, many phrases mirror one another. It's actually an incredible thing to look at. So there's some deep connection between the story of Yosef and the story of the Megillah. I'm going to try to bring that out a little bit. There is a Medrash that makes the connection. The Medrash does not go through it at length. It doesn't go through it in depth and go through all of the references. But there is a Medrash that compares Yosef to Esther and makes maybe two or three points comparing the two stories in Esther Rabbah, Perek Zion. So we do find a reference in Chazal for this connection. But as you look through the stories, you'll see that the connection is apparent. It just jumps out at you. And we have to figure out what is the message of this connection. So I want to try to go through right now. I have a list here of about 13 similarities and connections in the story. I think if you actually got more into the nitty-gritty of the text, you'd probably come up with like 25 or 30 connections. I'm not going to do that right now. But the connections are very apparent and pretty astounding. So let's just start slowly and work through each one. So Yosef, he rose to power in Egypt, and he was given the Egyptian name Tsofnas Paneach. Paro called him not Yosef, he called him Tsofnas Paneach. Tsofnas Paneach translates, Tsofnas means that which is hidden. Paneach means that which is exposed or revealed. The one who is able to decipher that which is hidden, that's Tsofnas Paneach. Mifaneach razim means you're able to, you know, solve a solution or a riddle. That's the word means. So Yosef's name in Egyptian was Tsofnas Paneach, the one who's able to discern that which is hidden. Why was he called that? Because Paro saw Yosef's ability to interpret dreams. Now Paro had his dreams, nobody else could interpret those dreams, and Yosef's able to interpret them. So Paro said, you're Tsofnas Paneach, you're someone who's able to decipher that which is hidden or concealed from others. Megillas Esther, besides the understanding of the story, that it's all about being able to discern the hidden, discern a hidden miracle, the term Megillas Esther, the Vilna Gaon says, Esther is a term Seser, which is hidden. Megillas from the word Megale, which is to reveal. And Megillas Esther, in another understanding, means that which reveals the hidden. Megillas Esther, Megale HaHester. You're able to reveal that which is hidden. So Yosef's name really is Megillas Esther. You know, to me, that itself is pretty astounding. Tsofnas Paneach, the one which is able to discern that which is hidden. Megillas Esther is that which reveals the hidden. So that's number one. Number two, and this is a connection the Medrash makes, both Yosef and Esther come from the same family, meaning they're both children of Rachel Imenu. Now there's 12 Shvatim, two born to Rachel, two born to Bilhah, two born to Zilpah, and six born to Leah. So the two children of Rachel were Binyamin and Yosef. So Yosef is a child of Rachel, and Esther and Mordechai descend from Binyamin. So they're both from the family of Rachel. Now, along with that actually comes the description which we have about Rachel and about Yosef and Esther, all the same description. So I've just pulled out my chumash for a second over here. When Yaakov first meets Rachel in Parshas Vayetze, so the Torah describes Rachel as Yifas Tor Vifas Mare. She was beautiful of form and appearance. So it's a double language to describe the beauty of Rachel. Yosef is described with a similar term in Parshas Vayeshev. When Yosef is just enters into Potiphar's house, we learn the story, and he's put to the test by Ishes Potiphar. So Yosef is described there as well as, in the masculine form of the word, Yefei Toar Vifei Mare. So Rachel is Yefas Toar Vifas Mare. Yosef is Yefei Toar Vifei Mare. And then Esther in the Megillah is also described in the same terminology. Esther is described as somebody who is, let's read you the pasuk from the Megillah. It says, "Vanara yefas tor v'tovas mare." She had a beautiful form and beautiful appearance. So Esther, Yosef are described in the same way, and so is Rachel, you know, their mother, great grandmother, with that same terminology. I didn't look this up. I did see a commentary point out that nobody else in all of Tanakh is described with these terms besides Rachel, Yosef, and Esther. Those are the only ones used. People are described as beautiful, but it's usually only one term, you know, Yefei Toar, Yefas Toar. But to say you're Yefas Toar Vifas Mare, this double language describing the beauty is only described with Rachel, Esther, and Yosef. So very interesting how Yosef and Esther have that same description. Furthermore, we learned at length in the past few weeks, wherever Yosef went, he was he found chen in the eyes of others. He had a certain charm. He had a certain, you know, magnetic draw. Everybody around Yosef was just drawn towards him. And whether he was working as a servant in Potiphar's house, whether he was a servant, a slave in jail, or whether he ascended to power with Pharaoh, the Torah describes him as somebody with this special chen, and everybody who saw Yosef was drawn towards Yosef. With Esther as well in the Megillah, it says, Esther noses chen be'enei koro eha. Esther was able to bring out this chen, this charm, in the eyes of all around her. So there was something about the two of them which went beyond physical beauty. I mean, the idea of chen, when it says yefas tor yefas mare, so that's a description of physical beauty. That there's a physical beauty which both Yosef and Esther had. Chen is a charm, we'll call it more like charm. Charm is not beauty. No, people who have charm are not necessarily the most beautiful externally, but there's something about them that just draws us in. There's this magnetic, like, you know, magic about a person that charms you, even though they're not the most, you know, objectively beautiful people. So beyond the objective beauty, which both Yosef and Esther had, they both possessed this trait of chen. And that chen helped them to achieve what they achieved. Yosef, through his chen, through his beauty and charm, was able to rise to power both in as a slave, as a prisoner, and as royalty. And Esther, through her chen, was chosen to be queen. Esther had no desire to be queen. All the other women of the empire were all sort of jockeying for the job, and Esther didn't want it. But because Achashverosh saw her, she had this like special chen that no one else had, he was drawn to her. Obviously, that was Hashem's hashkacha, that's part of the divine plan. But that itself is a fascinating thing, that both of them were able to use this chen to rise to power. Next similarity. Now, Esther rose to power from being an orphan. She was orphaned of her father and her mother, the Megillah says, raised by Mordechai, who was her cousin. And from her state of being an orphan, you know, somebody who was a needy, parentless child, she rose to power as queen. Yosef also was effectively an orphan. He lost his mother young. His mother Rachel died in the birth of Binyamin, and he was sold off from his father. His father had no connection with him anymore. So his father was still alive, but his father and him had no more relationship because Yosef was sold as a slave and he was, you know, stuck in Egypt. So Yosef also was effectively orphaned of his parents, and from that state, he rose straight to power. So both of them were in a state of being orphans, and from there they ended up as royalty, both Yosef and Esther. The obviously there's an obvious connection in the fact that both of them are Jews that rose to royalty in unlikely ways. Esther, as we said, was an orphan girl raised by her cousin who was doing anything she could to avoid getting the job. She did not want to be queen. She didn't think anything good would come of it. And somehow, miraculously, surprisingly, suddenly she finds herself as the queen, you know, something that she never dreamed of. Yosef as well. I mean, Yosef wasn't as opposed to it as Esther was, but Yosef as well, he was there in prison. He had no hopes or dreams of becoming a king or royalty. No, he just wanted to get out of jail. That's all he wanted. And somehow he rose to power from being a prisoner to Egyptian royalty in one day. Esther went from being an orphan Jewish girl to royalty also in one day. Same idea. Now, both Esther and Yosef used their power to help out Klal Yisrael. Yosef rose to power, and he was able to save and provide food for his brothers when they came down to Egypt. Esther rose to power, and we know the story. Esther was able to move in to Achashverosh and convince him to save all the Jews and kill Haman. So both of them they rose to power, you know, surprisingly, miraculously, suddenly, and that power was used to help out Klal Yisrael. You find in both stories of Yosef and the story of Megillas Esther that Jews are given over the tabas, the signet ring of the king. So now moving past Esther into Mordechai, also similarities. Now Yosef, it says, when he was appointed as second in command to Paro, so the pasuk says, let's read that to you. The page over here. The pasuk says, "V'yasar Paro es tabato mi'al yado." Paro removed the ring from his hand. V'itenosa al yad Yosef, and he put it onto Yosef's hand. So Yosef was given the ring of Paro to do as he saw fit. We know at the end of the Purim story. I mean, the beginning, the ring was given to Haman, but at the end of the Purim story, that ring is taken from Haman, and that ring is given to Mordechai, and Mordechai is told, "Do as you see fit." So in both stories, a Jew is given basically the power from this world emperor, and that allows them to use their power to help out the Jewish people. And the story of the ring is in both stories. We find in both stories as well that the Jewish ruler is paraded through the city. When Yosef is chosen to be second in command to Paro, it says, he was put into the second chariot of Paro. It's like, you know, Air Force Two or something. Bikru lefan of Avreich. And they yelled out before him, Avreich. And they took him through all of Eretz Mitzrayim, basically. So they paraded him through Eretz Mitzrayim. The story of Mordechai, we know that Haman was forced to parade Mordechai through the streets. So both of them, as they rose to power, got to experience this parade, trying to display their power to the masses. Additionally, next one, we know that the turning point in both stories, the story of Paro and the story of Achashverosh, they both happened through a king losing sleep. Interesting thing to think about. We know in the story of Yosef that how did Yosef rise to power? Because Paro couldn't sleep. Because Paro was having these dreams that were keeping him up at night. And he couldn't figure out what the issue of the dreams were. They spoke to all his royal advisors, and they couldn't give him a good interpretation. So at that point, the chief butler remembered that, oh, in prison there is this Jew who knows how to interpret dreams. And they brought out Yosef to Paro, and Yosef interpreted the dream, and Paro chose Yosef to be second in command. So but in the story of Yosef and Paro, Yosef's rise to power began with Paro not being able to sleep at night, being tormented by a dream. So too, the Achashverosh, it says in the Megillah, B'laylahu narnas nasa melech, it was on that night where the king could not sleep. The Medrash actually tells us that it was a dream that was actually disturbing him. He was being disturbed by a dream. That's not in the Megillah itself, but there was a dream disturbing him. But the Megillah was very clear that Achashverosh could not sleep. And it was that night where he called his royal advisors in, read to me from the books of the Persian Chronicles, and they recalled to him the story of Mordechai saving his life from Bigthan and Seresh, who went to assassinate him. So at that point, he rewarded Mordechai. How did he reward Mordechai? This is the story where Haman came in. And he said, how can I reward someone who honored the king? And he says, you know, put him onto the royal horse and put on the royal garments and parade him through the streets. and say, Kach yaseh le'ish, this is what you do to the one who does good to the king. So both stories, there's a big turning point when the king couldn't sleep. Just to go off on that for 1 second, just a little bit of a tangent, but an important point. People are bothered by the following fact. Why is that story of Megillah so important anyways? I mean, the Megillah describes the story of Mordechai being led around on the horse by Haman. It's a cute part of the story. We enjoy the image of Haman being ridiculed, having to lead around Mordechai on the horse, the same guy he wanted to hang on that very day. Instead, he's there parading him around the streets and serving him as a servant, giving him honor. So it's a very cute part of the story. It kind of shows how ridiculous Haman looked and how Hashem turned the tables. But why is that essential to the miracle? Meaning, I'm calling it a turning point in the story. So I understand in Yosef's story, had Paro not woken up from these dreams, Yosef would have still been languishing in prison. That we get. But in the story of Achashverosh, if Achashverosh slept well that night and didn't have Haman parading Mordechai through the streets, what would have changed exactly? So you could say, well, Haman may have killed Mordechai. This is possible. I mean, at that point, it could be Haman would put his request into the king and killed Mordechai. So that's one way to look at it. But I believe it's the Eben Ezra who says another point. The Eben Ezra says, Esther in the story of the Megillah, she throws two parties. The first day she goes into the king, he says to her, what would you like? She says, I want to invite you and Haman to a party. He says, great. They go to the party, and the king says, what would you like? She says, come tomorrow for another party. At the second party, she turns in Haman. So you read the Megillah, and you wonder, like, what was she waiting for? Why did she have to have a second party? At the first party, turned in Haman. Like, why are you turning him in only at the second party? So again, I think it's the Eben Ezra who says that Esther at the first party was not ready yet to make her move. Why? Because she wasn't yet sure that Hashem had accepted our tefillos and was ready to make a miracle. Why? Because she saw nothing change. From the day before, when Haman sent out these royal decrees to kill all the Jews, to the next day when they were sitting at this party, nothing had changed. She had no sign from Hashem that he was prepared to now save Klal Yisrael, do a miracle, step in on our behalf. So he calls the first party, and she's trying to figure out, is there a sign from heaven over here that I should now make my move? And nothing occurred, no such thing. So she hesitates, and she says, okay, let's just try again tomorrow. So she tells Achashverosh, come back tomorrow for another party, and I'll tell you my request then. Now, in between the two parties, what happened? In between the two parties that night where Achashverosh couldn't sleep, and Haman has to lead Mordechai around on the horse, so Esther says, I see my sign. Now that I see that Haman is being ridiculed and Mordechai is being honored, that's a sign from Hashem that it's time to make the move. Hashem has accepted our tshuva, accepted our tefillos, he's ready to make miracles, and therefore she's able to make her request the next day and turn in Haman and have Haman killed. So, but it was really that story which gave Esther the encouragement and the sign from Shemayim that it was time to make a move. So that's why it was a turning point, because when she saw that, she knew, now I can turn in Haman and I'm not going to be concerned because I know Hashem is on our side. So the turning point of both stories of Yosef and Esther was a point when a king could not sleep. Next similarity is that both the story of Yosef and the story of Esther, they both hide their identity. Yosef hides his identity from his brothers, and Esther hides her identity from Achashverosh. We know that Mordechai told Esther, don't tell him who you are. Keep it a secret. We're going to hold that back until the right time. And Yosef also holds back his identity until the right time. We spoke about last week why Yosef did that. He didn't want to expose himself to his brothers until all the different parts of his plan came together. But ultimately, in both stories, you have somebody who's holding back their identity until the right time occurs. Another connection, and this we actually have in the language itself, and the Medrash points this out. In the story of Yosef, we know that he is challenged by Eshes Potiphar. Potiphar's wife comes to Yosef, and day after day, she tries to seduce him and challenge him and make him succumb to adultery. The Torah uses the wording in that story. Let's go back to that. It says, Sorry. Vahikadabro Yosef Yom Yom. It says that she would speak to him every single day. Yom Yom. So it was a daily challenge. There's pressure that occurred to him every single day. She would come to him, and every day, day in, day out, he had to use self-control and hold back from giving in to this to his desire. Mordechai also is challenged every single day. Mordechai is supposed to bow down to Haman. Everyone in the entire kingdom is commanded to bow down to Haman, and Mordechai refuses. And the Megillah uses the same exact terminology. It says, "Vahi kiamram elav yom vayom." It says every single day the servants would say to Mordechai, "Madua televeres mitzvas hamelach? Why are you violating the king's command?" So both Mordechai and Yosef had a daily struggle, a daily battle. The term yom yom is used concerning both of them, and both of them are able to hold strong to their values and beliefs and resist to not give in. But they both have to deal with this daily pressure to put aside their own personal morals or values and give in to the pressure around them. Yosef to Ishes Potiphar and Mordechai to everyone else bowing down to Haman in the kingdom. In both stories, these stories end with the Jews still in Golus in exile, but in control. The story of Yosef ends where the Jews are in Mitzrayim, they're down in Egypt, and Yosef is the ruler of Egypt. And the story of the Megillah ends that the Jews are all in Persia, and Esther is the queen of Persia, and Mordechai is the viceroy of Persia. So both stories kind of end in a similar situation. Now from there, it goes different directions. In the story of Yosef, from there, it continued on into the Egyptian slavery and exile. So things went downhill from there in the Yosef story. In the story of Esther, that led to the end of the Persian exile, the building of the second Beis HaMikdash, and the Jews returning to Eretz Yisrael. So Esther's story ends in exile, but leads to a positive note. Yosef's story ends in exile, but leads to a difficult time for Klal Yisrael. But they both end with the Jews in exile and with a Jew in charge of the country they're in, which also is a very interesting connection. As an aside, one of the reasons why we don't see Halal on Purim, the Gemara asked the question, why don't we see Halal on Purim? And the Gemara says, we really should, because if we say Halal on Pesach, and that was only being saved from Avdus to Chirus, from slavery to freedom, so then on Purim, when we went from death to life, that's even a greater praise of Hashem. That's a bigger salvation. Death to life is something to praise Hashem for more powerfully than slavery to freedom. So Gemara is bothered by, why is there no obligation to say Halal on Purim? And the Gemara gives three answers, and one of those answers is that since the story ends, the Jews still in exile, it's not a complete salvation quite yet. Akati avdi achashverosh anan. We still were servants by achashverosh, even post-Purim story, and therefore it doesn't warrant a halo. It's one of the answers the Gemara gives. But it shows that both stories kind of ended in limbo. You know, things are not all rosy quite yet in either story. Again, in the Megillah story, things will get better. In Yosef's story, things will first get worse. But both end in a state where we had a miracle occur. We still have a Jew in power, but yet we're not quite where we need to be. So these are all connections between two stories. There are many more. I'm not sharing them all with you. I saw more, in my research, and you get into the real textual connections in terms of the words. There's a lot of similar phrases and nuances in both stories that connect them. But putting all this together, I think everyone's convinced these stories are connected. It's clear. From a bigger picture, both stories are incredible descriptions of Hashem's providence, Hashkacha on the world. Both stories start off in a very, the Jews are just minding their own business in the Persian Empire. Yaakov's sons are just doing their thing as shepherds, in Eretz Yisrael. And just the pieces all come together in both stories to bring to a certain goal or a certain pivotal point in history that comes in both stories. Both are incredible lessons of Hashkacha of Hashem. They both contain within them hidden miracles, Nisim Nistarim, symbols how Hashem pulls all the strings of history and runs the world in amazing ways. We know that Yosef's story, we spoke about a little bit last week, Yosef's story really is an incredible story of Hashkacha. It really is. Meaning to take Yosef as one of Yaakov's sons and have him sold off as kidnapped and sold as a slave, and have him end up as the ruler of Egypt in a position to help out his brothers, it's an astounding turn of events. If we were to see that happen in modern times, it's jaw-dropping. We read it as a story in the Chumash, so it's just another Chumash story for us. But if we saw that happen in modern times, we would be totally floored by it. If somebody in your neighborhood disappeared, Chas v'Shalom, was kidnapped, and 20 years later we find him, as the prime minister of England, and he was a slave a day before that, we'd be like, wow, like what happened over here? And it's what happens to Yosef. And the way it happens, though, you don't see any open miracles with Yosef. It's all the idea of the hidden miracle. No seas were split, no man fell from the sky. There's no 10 plagues. It's just that Hashem was able to orchestrate events along the way that brought Yosef to where he ended up. And Yosef himself recognizes that. Yosef at the end, when his brothers come and he reveals himself, and they're all nervous, and Yosef's gonna take revenge against us. Yosef is the second to command all of Egypt. We did a terrible crime by selling him off. What's he gonna do to us? And when Yosef reveals himself to his brothers, he recognizes, no, it's all from Hashem, it's all Hashgacha. He says, don't be upset, don't remorse that you sold me. Hashem sent me before you to provide for you. Hashem sent me, meaning Yosef recognized everything as part of Hashem's plan. And he saw that whatever happened to me, it was a difficult time, the past 22 years, which is how long it took until he reunited with his father. But at that time, I recognized all Hashem's plan. It was all Hashem bringing us to a certain goal. Miguel's Esther the same way. Esther, she doesn't realize until the end why she's queen. But it seems very clear that Esther understood she was there for a reason. She didn't know why. Meaning that Hashem, she understood along the way, Hashem is setting up some sort of circumstances that my power will help Klal Yisrael. I'm not sure why. And if you go to the timeline of the Megillah, it's very interesting because she was chosen as the queen in the, I think it was the fifth year of Achashverosh's reign, if I'm remembering the numbers right. Let me just confirm that for a moment to give you the right numbers. It says in the second parak of the Megillah, is the seventh year of his reign. So it's the seventh, so that the Vashti was killed in the third year of Achashverosh's reign. Esther was taken as queen in the seventh year of Achashverosh's reign. And then the story of Purim happened in the 12th year of Achashverosh's reign. So there are 5 years where Esther was queen in the palace of Achashverosh. And there's nothing doing, meaning she didn't know, like, why did Hashem put me here? What's the purpose of this all? And then eventually what happens is she figures it out. Mordechai sees all the cards on the table. She understands, Mordechai gets what's happening, goes to Esther, says, it's your time to intervene. This is why you are Malchus. This is why you're royalty. So Mordechai tells her, maybe this is the reason why Hashem puts you in charge. And she's able to see that Hashgacha, to have the courage to go into Achashverosh, even the risk of her life, and save Klal Yisrael. At the end of the Purim story, you look back and you see everything as a tremendous miracle. So too in Yosef's story, Yosef isn't sure exactly what Hashem was doing, but when his brothers come, and Yosef thinks back to the dreams, and he sees the opportunity now to reunite with his family and to support Klal Yisrael and to provide for them food, so Yosef figures out that this is a tremendous stroke of Hashgacha leading me to this goal. So both stories, along the way, you don't necessarily understand the miracles occurring and what the purpose of the miracles are. But at the end, you're able to look back and understand how miraculous it really was and how Hashem runs the world in hidden in tremendous ways. So that's one, I think, common denominator between both stories. Number two, I think you see also another common thread between Esther and Yosef, which is both of them really serve as shining models of Kiddush Hashem in the eyes of the Gentiles, of the non-Jewish nations that they were in. I mean, Yosef, like we keep saying, throughout the whole story, everyone who meets Yosef is totally charmed by him. They recognize his great personality and his devotion to God and his honesty and his wisdom. And everyone who meets Yosef just is respectful, and they end up recognizing the greatness of Yosef, this Jew, there wasn't a very famous thing to be a Jew in those times. I mean, some people knew about Abraham and his family, but they recognized Yosef's upstanding qualities, his nobility, his honesty, his morality, and he's able to be an example to everybody around him about what it means to be a Jew. And that was recognized again, both as a slave, as a prisoner, and as royalty. In all three circumstances, everyone recognized Yosef's shining qualities, being Mekadosh Shemayim. Esther as well. Esther was taken into the palace. The minute she walked in to the palace from the beginning, even before she was chosen as queen, everybody was just floored by Esther. And she wasn't trying to act beautiful. She wanted to get out of it. She didn't want any makeup. She didn't want any perfume. It says in the Megillah, she wanted to get through this, you know, as quick as possible, as painless as possible, and go back home. But everybody was just taken by Esther, by her noble qualities. And as queen, she charmed all those there around her, and she stands for us as a shining model of Kiddush Hashem. Now, beyond that, both Esther and Yosef, within the pressures of being in those positions, were able to still stick to their own values. We know that Esther and Yosef, the rabbis tell us, they both kept kosher in the royal palace. They're both able to maintain their commitment to being Jews and to Hashem, even with the external pressures around them of acting as royalty and knowing if they're discovered keeping mitzvos, it could end up being very bad for them. But despite that, they're able to maintain, you know, that devotion to Hashem. I mean, Mekadosh Shemayim through their actions. And at the end, it was revealed to all who they were. At the end, Yosef's family came in, and everyone knew Yosef descended from Yaakov, and that became something which everyone knew about and respected. And at the end, Esther revealed to everyone who she was, and that she was, you know, raised by Mordechai, and that she was a Jew, and everyone respected the Jews at the end. So in both stories, there was this respect that was elicited by Yosef and Esther for the entire Jewish people. Now, they both mentioned descent from Rachel. Now, Rachel, we spoke about way back. Rachel is someone described as beautiful externally, and she stands for the what we would call the outward beauty of Klal Yisrael. Meaning, the Jewish people, we have an inner beauty and an outer beauty. So the outer beauty is not always recognized. The inner beauty is always there. So Leah represents the inner beauty, and Rachel is the outer beauty. The fact that she has two descendants that are described as beautiful, and they bring to the world around them, to the non-Jewish world, the beauty of what it means to be a Jew, that very much fits Rachel's role, because Rachel's role was to be the outer beauty of Klal Yisrael. She's the one who's supposed to present to the world how Klal Yisrael outwardly is a beautiful, charming nation. Whereas Leah's greatest quality was inner quality. She had her Nea Rakos, you know, she had beauty through her eyes. You know, the eyes are the window into the soul. And that was Leah's beauty. So it makes very much sense that Rachel's two descendants here are the ones out there in the world, acting kind of as spokespeople for Klal Yisrael, representing Klal Yisrael and being Mekadosh Shemayim through their actions. I think another major lesson you have from both stories is to never give up hope. In both stories, I mean, we could have said we were hopeless. Yosef sold as a slave, then framed and thrown into prison. He was in a state of hopelessness. I mean, why should he think he'll ever get out of there? When you're tossed into Paro's prison, it probably wasn't so common to get out of Paro's prison. I can imagine Paro had very kind terms in terms of just jail sentencing. But Yosef never gave up. Now, Yosef, he was able to maintain his hope throughout the entire story. And with Hashem's help, he rose to power and was able to save Klal Yisrael. The story of Purim as well. The Jews also could have lost hope. I mean, it says in the Megillah that Haman made a decree, sent up by Achashverosh, sealed with the royal signet ring, and the terminology used is nechtav et masa melech. It was signed and sealed with the king's signet ring. And we know that once it's sealed, it can't be rescinded, the Megillah says. And the rabbis tell us, not only did Achashverosh agree to this decree, but the word ha-melech in the Megillah refers to Hashem as well. It's always a double meaning. And when it says the king sealed the decree, it means not only Achashverosh, but Hashem sealed the decree. Hashem is on board with it, as it were. Hashem, at least externally, was there to say that I am on board with Klal Yisrael being destroyed. They deserve it. That's how sinful they've been. And in both stories, we could have totally given up, lost hope, despaired, said forget about it. But in both stories, Yosef never gave up, never lost hope, always remained positive, always remained optimistic. And the story of Purim as well, Mordechai says, okay, we can handle it. We got to daven. We have to fast. we have to do our proper effort to shtadlus to go into Achashverosh and plead for our lives. Mordechai says to Esther, if you don't do it, we'll be saved anyways. Mordechai was confident. If you don't go in, we will be saved from some other source, but you'll be destroyed. That's what he tells Esther. Mordechai never for a moment gave up hope. He said, we're going to pull through. How it's going to happen? Well, Esther, it could be through you. And if you don't do it, someone else will do it. But we don't give up hope. Hashem, both stories tell you that Hashem can do anything for us at any time, at any moment. Never forget that. You know, you can go from being in jail to being king in a matter of hours. You go from being an orphaned girl to being the queen of Persia in a matter of hours. You know, nothing stands in Hashem's way. We understand that the hearts of kings, the Torah tells us, are in the hands of Hashem, and the world's run by Hashem. And both stories are such lessons of Hashkacha that anything can happen anytime. Never give up hope. Never think, okay, the doctor said this, and you know the army said this, and the president said this. Whoever is threatening you and saying something wrong is happening. Hashem is always there to save us at any single moment, and miracles can occur at a moment's notice. Yeshua Hashem Geherif Ayin, it says Hashem's salvation is like in the blink of an eye. And Esther and Yosef are both examples of that. So to me, I think there's a lot more to be said, even in these connections. And I think this is only the start of it. But these stories really play hand in hand and teach us the very similar lessons. And as we go through Purim and read the Megillah, I think a major lesson is to realize never give up hope. Know that Hashem is there at every single moment. Understand that Hashem runs the world. Every single event is there for a reason, bringing us to a certain goal. And even though you don't know it at the time, you don't see it, neither did Yosef, neither did Esther. But at the end, they both ended up where they're supposed to go.
Two things. I just wanted to, as you were saying this, it occurred to me two things. Number one, that in both stories, you have a signet ring, right? When Paro gives it to Yosef.
Right.
And here, but it's used for to give him the power. But in the other way, the signet ring was for Haman's decree. So it was put Yosef in charge, but the other one looked like it sealed the fate. But it's just interesting that I don't know where else we see anything about a ring. Maybe there are other in the Tanakh, but I don't know. But those are the two that stand out to me.
Right. That's right.
Interesting. The other thing is I read recently, yesterday, and I don't know if this is true, maybe you've heard about this, that Esther's date of death was the same as Moshe, Zayin Adar?
I'm not aware of that, but
I don't know. I just heard that.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Confirm. Yeah.
So, okay, interesting. Very interesting. I don't know.
It could be two people who have really saved the Jewish people, so to speak, whatever.
Right.
If they died, I don't know. That's the first time I saw it, but I have to look back and see where that comes from.
Okay, let's find a source. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Interesting to know.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, everyone should have a Freilich and Purim.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Great class.
Thank you, Zvi. Be well.
Welcome, thank you.